Wanna see my picture on the cover. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother.
Yeah!
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, from the June 2025 edition of Rolling Stone magazine. Random Notes. A question and answer. Pete Townsend. We're dealing in mythology now. The co-founder and guitarist of The Who talks about 6 decades with the band and whether this really is their final tour. The Who practically invented the concept of the rock and roll farewell tour back in 1982 when they hit the road for what they claimed was the final time. 7 years later, they practically invented the concept of the forget that whole farewell thing tour when they reformed for a lucrative run of stadium shows. They've been active for the past 30 years, but now they're kicking off a second farewell tour. And this time around, they mean it. The tour is just one project that band co-founder and guitarist Pete Townsend, age 80, has in the works. He's also releasing a 7-disc box set that chronicles his solo career, working with young bands, The Wild Things, and Bookshop, and writing new songs. Townsend says, I've got maybe 10 years left as a creative, so I'm doing all kinds of interesting things. I'm trying to keep myself fueled up. And here's a Q&A. Question. John Entwistle made his first solo record in 1971, Roger Daltrey in 1973, and Keith Moon in 1975. You didn't do a proper one until 1980. Why you're the last? Townsend. Because I was writing the songs for the fucking Who, that's why. Question. A lot of people heard Rough Boys and felt it was you basically coming out of the closet. Townsend. I think it was that in a sense. What's misconstrued is the fact that I was ever in the closet. I'd had a few gay experiences and just decided really that wasn't for me. But there was certainly a period when I was a young man hanging out with Who managers Chris Stamp and Kit Lampert. I look back and I realize I wanted to be gay, but for all the wrong reasons. Not because of a love, a physical love for men, but because it was cool, because it was illegal, because it was dangerous. Question. Slit Skirts starts with, I was just 34 years old and I was still wandering in a haze. Did you feel old at 34? Townsend, I think everybody does. You think 30 is going to be difficult, and I think it is. But I think that the years leading up to 30 are terrible for people, because you expect a doorway to come down, and it doesn't. The thing that I was going through at the time was punk. I was pissed off about 2 things. 1, that I was too old to be part of it. But 2, the fact that they stole my fucking idea. Question. It's true. Townsend. The Who was supposed to self-combust within 6 months. Instead of self-combusting honorably and getting out of the fucking way, we went on and on and on, performing like fucking monkeys, smashing guitars and swinging microphones and doing the Keith Moon routine. And what happened with punk was that they took away my original manifesto and put it in practice. Question. In the new liner notes to the box set, you wrote, I handed the stadium stage to Queen and U2 and, of course, to Bruce Springsteen. But we should have been a part of that post-punk legacy act resurgence that those acts enjoyed. Can you elaborate on that? Townsend. The Who invented stadium rock. We gave it away. Our timing was terrible, but when we did Live Aid, we could barely fucking play. Queen were in the middle of a tour, walked out there, and turned it into an advert for themselves. I never really appreciated what Queen was about, to be honest. I liked ABBA, but I didn't really connect it with the lighthearted pop diversity of Queen's catalog. I'm a huge fan of Bruce and a big fan of U2, and very happy to see the way that they made the stadium mantle. But with songs like Won't Get Fooled Again and Baba O'Reilly, I fucking nailed it. There's no question, and I gave that instrumentation away. but it would have been wrong to say that I regret it because I don't. Question. In the 90s, it felt like The Who were often mentioned in the same breath as The Beatles, The Stones, and Led Zeppelin. It seems young people aren't as aware of your work as they used to be. Do you care? Townsend. I think they may not be, and no, I don't really care that much. I think because we're dealing in mythology now, which has actually been fed by social media and by streaming. It's a vicious world. The Stones didn't help themselves, do they, really? I think they made so many really interesting albums, which they, in a sense, disowned. My favorite Stones album is still Aftermath. Brian Jones was still alive and kicking and had ideas. A bit hippy-dumb, but it was interesting. The Beatles just didn't last long enough. And the same thing happened with the Beach Boys. Once the Beach Boys had done Pet Sounds, you could have a conversation with Brian Wilson. I wonder whether kids who think that Jimmy Page is the best guitar player in the world have heard Pet Sounds. Not that it's got anything to do with guitar playing, but it's where the myths begin and myths end. Question. The Who are launching a tour later this year. Might you do a show that's less focused on the big hits? Townsend. We'd love to. One of the reasons we don't play a lot of the tracks we like to play is because they're fucking difficult. That said, I think there's an argument for playing the songs that the audience want, because a lot of them are coming to see you because they think they may never have a chance to see you. And although they may not be 100% invested in the mythology of The Who, they do know that The Who are important and they may never see them again. And on to music reviews. Turnstile's Post Hardcore Exhibition. Turnstile, the album Never Enough on the Roadrunner label. 3.5 stars. Turnstile's much-anticipated follow-up to 2021's massive Glow On Never Enough is like a mysterious gallery. It's not so much a collection of tracks, but impressions, aerial vignettes, that are more about a feeling than a message, a vibe that listeners can pursue at their leisure, like wandering through an echoing portrait hall. It makes sense that frontman Brandon Yates has dubbed himself an art director this time around, as the band takes another step towards challenging the already blurry edges of genre and creating something entirely new. The Baltimore hardcore band has always pushed back against convention. Glow On mixed everything from samba and funk with alacrity, and genre purists have often balked at their flirtations with the mainstream. Much like Glow On, the band's fourth album sounds like the future, if the future is the realm Bill and Ted visited, with all those guys in shiny silver suits playing electric guitars like saints giving benediction. Take the opening title track, which ascends a staircase of sounds. Trippy sniffs, exploding into Pat McCrory and new guitarist Meg Mills, ripping on 80s guitars. Dev Hines on sweet cello, and Daniel Fang tearing into his drum kit. It's a transition into soul, one of the hardest tracks on the album. Dough, produced in part by hyperpop innovator A.G. Cook, sounds like a boxing match, while the standout Sunshower is a moment of hardcore delirium that's like a temper tantrum in a rainstorm. Ceiling is a contemplative track that evocatively kicks off with a ticking clock, while the 80s-tinged Scene Stars undulates like a late-night club track with almost indistinguishable additional vocals from Hines and Haley Williams. And Birds, it's more like the Hitchcock movie than anything else. The last song exhibit, Magic Man, a sheer-as-gauze wisp of a track, could be about the sleight of hand that goes into being a musician. Quote, wandering the world, but the world's got a plan of its own. It's a fitting end to a haunting collection that's worth repeat visits. Moving on to Cocktail Hour with Matt Berninger. Matt Berninger, the album Get Sunk on the Concord label, with 3 stars. Maybe after once in a lifetime, we'll figure out what we've lost. Matt Berninger sings on No Love, a reflectively lachrymose highlight from his second solo album. The national frontman sounds like he could spend several lifetimes pondering that question. On Get Sunk, he continues to work the same tastefully tortured alt-rock he does so well, making his most microscopically observed thoughts, pains, and worries into lovely tunes like the slowly building rocker Bonnet of Pins, the orchestral folk tune Breaking into Acting, and the jazz-infected Silver Jeep. The music is more subdued than his main band, created with collaborators like soul great Booker T. Jones and Meg Duffy of Hand Habits, giving Berninger the right backdrop to draw every scintilla of high-end malaise from lines like God Loves the Island Ocean, Lost Cause, I Have No Emotion. The album ending Times of Difficulty turns the emo marching order Get Drunk / Get Sunk into an inward spelunking cur de cur. But the overall effect is more generous and angst-ridden, a Nabokov cocktail for literate Gen X bros lurching through the suburban blues one regret at a time. And now, staff picks, five recent albums we can't get enough of. Sinaleski, Gen Z. Though 27-year-old Sinaleski hasn't had the same crossover success as his Nigerian street pop peer Asake, his sophomore effort displays the rich production, cool wit, and youthful zeal that has made him beloved at home. He's a subtle master of moods, from the triumphant Two Baba Flex to the sexy electric Suit and Tie with hip-hop crooner Tosi. Cameron Winter, Heavy Metal. Cameron Winter, frontman for Brooklyn post-punk's Geese, shows a Harry Nilsson-esque knack for coaxing the weird from the poignant on his solo debut. The 70s pop rock palette wobbles as it swoons, while Winter's baritone flexes from strung out and weary to high wire alive as he courts love, disillusionment, and transcendence. Suzanne Vega, Flying with Angels. Four decades after her new waif debut, Suzanne Vega retains her knack for crisp, lucid observations and a voice to match. Whether she's singing about unexpected maladies or Ukrainians fleeing their country, but she also reveals her wry, playful side. Natalie Lafourcade, Canansera. Since emerging as a guitar-wielding indie pop darling in the early 2000s, Natalie Lafourcade has reinvented herself and explored the profound roots of Mexican folk. Her sumptuous new album, Canansera, goes further, landing as a heartfelt commitment to the power of traditional sounds like ranchera, sonjerco, and classic bolero. Mamalarque, Hex Key. This L.A. band has roots that go back to playing together in junior high, and you can hear that deep chemistry here. Its shape-shifting indie pop incorporates everything from 80s synth rock and metal to R&B and airy guitar prettiness, as singer-guitarist Livy Bennett amiably leads us down the forked path of each tune like she's smiling through a dream. And now the Rolling Stone essay. The pop queens are the new rock gods. Today's biggest stars are creating a new stadium rock paradigm. Olivia Rodrigo is riding high in her festival era. She's setting a new record by headlining 18 music festivals in 1 year, and she's doing it with a full-on rock show. To celebrate the fifth consecutive summer of Live, O-Rod's making the rounds from Lollapalooza in Chicago to Bonnaroo in Tennessee, to Governor's Ball in New York. But she's not alone. Female headliners are seizing center stage at the big summer fests, whether it's Gracie Abrams at Outside Lands or Charlie XCX headlining Glastonbury. Japel Roan's Lollapalooza triumph last year was just the beginning. We're living in an age when the pop queens have taken over as the new rock gods. When Lollapalooza first announced that Olivia and Sabrina Carpenter were headlining this summer, along with Tyler, the Creator, and Rufus Du Sol, with Abrams also in a top slot, there was the predictable gnashing of teeth that Lollapalooza is abandoning its precious rock heritage. Dude, what are all the pop girls doing here? But Olivia, Sabrina, Chappelle, Gracie, so many more. They're just creating a new world-beating stadium rock paradigm, guitars and all, going for the crowd-flattening mania that old-school rock stars seemed to give up on years ago. Olivia introduced the world to her new mojo at her South American shows this spring, streamlining her Guts show into a headbanger rock blast. She headlined at the Lollapalooza festivals in Argentina, Chile, and Brazil, facing the largest crowds of her career. This girl has always reveled in her rock moves. But Lola Olivia is cranking up the rockness and tossing everything else overboard. She skips the theater kid energy. She's not floating around the crowd perched on a crescent moon anymore. She begins with Obsessed, which is insane, playing up the aneuristic grunge aggro. Her killer all-female band gets plenty of room to show off. She covers Don't Speak, but turns her guitar ballads into even bigger stadium sing-along anthems. It's summed up in the great moment in Bad Idea Right, where she drops to her knees and crawls up a catwalk to kneel and worship her guitarist mid-solo. She's not exactly the first rock star to bust out that move, but she milks the moment for melodrama, always an Olivia specialty, until she makes it her own. Olivia has always flaunted her Jones for the old-school 90s rock queens ever since she covered Veruca Salt on her first tour. This is a girl who casually told Rolling Stone that her mom used to wake her up every morning by playing the Babes in Toyland album, Fontanelle, not even the Babes' most famous album, an impressive deep cut. But she's overtly celebrating her connection to the 90s female rock star legacy and bringing it into the future. On the Guts tour, she had Bikini Kill on her pre-show mix and hired the Breeders as her opening act. She told the crowd, "I remember my life in two distinct periods, before I heard Cannonball and after I heard Cannonball." So it's a full circle moment. As always, she obsesses over the details and knows her history inside and out. At Lollapalooza, Olivia's headlining right about the new metal legends Korn, which is just perfect. Korn blew up in the late 90s heyday of MTV's Total Request Live, where everyday fans' vote countdown was a battle between the Britney Backstreet Boys pop kids and the Korn Limp Bizkit rock kids. But now Korn are opening for a girl who combines the best of Britney and Korn, a freak off the leash. Chappelle Roan's Lollapalooza blowout last year was a real changing of the guard. It's crazy to think that Chappelle originally got booked for the small stage until they had to reschedule her for the main stage due to unprecedented demand. But her set blew up to the point where it was bigger than the rest of the festival combined, drawing quite possibly the hugest crowd in Lollapalooza history, a true phenomenon. Not many years ago, something like this would have been unthinkable, but that's the era we're living in now. It's a momentous change. The 90s Olivia's favorite music era was defined by a feminist rock explosion of artists making noise from the indie level to the arenas to the airways. But the backlash was harsh as the radio abruptly clamped down and stopped playing these artists. Woodstock 99 set the new tone with its misogynistic violence and new metal machismo. It marked the end of one era and the start of another, as the industry turned back the clock and returned to the days where all-male shows and festivals were the norm. By 2004, there was only one major rock tour all year to feature a female musician, the Pixies, on their reunion run with Kim Deal on bass. So it was sweet to see Kim raise hell with the Breeders on Olivia's Guts tour. And it was striking to note that between the two bands, there was only one male musician on stage all night, the Breeders' drummer. Sometimes it's the tiny ironies that tell the biggest story. But the Pop Girls have come to reclaim the rock star legacy and show everyone else how it's done. Live through this. Turning to movie and TV reviews. B-Movie Love makes A-plus TV. For the first series he's co-created in 15 years, Duster, J.J. Abrams brings his love of genre, crime capers, blaxploitation, all things 70s, to vivid life. As a filmmaker, J.J. Abrams wears his influences on his sleeve. A diehard Twilight Zone fan, he turned an episode of his first series, Felicity, into a black-and-white riff on that show's famous five characters in search of an exit, while Lost was full of Rod Serling-esque twists. Abrams' films as a director have included A Mission Impossible and two entrees apiece in the Star Trek and Star Wars franchises, and his one wholly original movie he also directed, Super 8, is an unmistakable homage to early Steven Spielberg. Star Trek Into Darkness and The Rise of Skywalker aside, J.J. Abrams is terrific at paying tribute to his favorite piece of pop culture. His gift for remixing is on strong display in Duster, the new period crime drama he has co-created with LaToya Morgan. Set in Arizona in 1972, it leans all the way into the fashion, music, and especially the movies and shows of the period. Leading man Josh Holloway sports a glorious blonde mane. Leading lady Rachel Hilson has an impressive afro, and you can feel the synthetic fibers of the clothes on your skin as you watch. The soundtrack is loaded with a classic rock and soul, and practically every scene references the films of that era, particularly gritty crime thrillers like Charlie Varick and The Outfit, or period pieces set around the same time. One episode features lesser-known songs from both the Reservoir Dogs and Boogie Nights soundtracks. This should all play like hollow mimicry, less tribute than televisual karaoke, but the affection that Abrams and Morgan have for this stuff is palpable, and the style they and co-collaborators like director Stephen Green bring it to its skillfully executed. The familiarity becomes a feature rather than a bug on the windshield of the titular Plymouth muscle car that Holloway's master getaway driver Jim Ellis uses to outrun all his problems. There's an elaborate plot in which rookie FBI agent Nina Hayes, Rachel Hilson, arrives in Phoenix, determined to bring down Jim's boss, Ezra Saxton, Keith David still in command of the best, richest voice in the character actor business. And that eventually involves Elvis Presley, Richard Nixon, Howard Hughes, and an assortment of rival crime families. Mostly, though, it's an excuse to let magnetic actors be magnetic and to show off analog car chases and stunts Hollywood rarely uses anymore. One character even watches the Steve McQueen movie Bullet, featuring one of the greatest car chases in cinema history, in case we didn't get the idea. Holloway is at least 20 years too old for the character as written, since Jim is both a Vietnam veteran and someone relatively low on Saxton's org chart. But his reunion with Abrams is a potent reminder of the scruffy charm he brought to con man Sawyer on Lost. It's just a pleasure to watch him swagger around in his wide-open shirts and flared pants, always calculating the escape route from any situation. Perhaps to lean into the age discrepancy, both David and Corbin Brenson, as Jim's dad, are older than a pair of World War II vets would be in 1972. Hilson, who played the young Beth in This Is Us flashbacks, is suitably badass, as someone whose race, gender, age, and size keep forcing establishment white guys to underestimate her. The narrative gets silly by the end of the 8-episode season, with characters making dumb choices solely to keep the plot moving. But the films and shows that inspired Duster didn't always hold up to close scrutiny either. And the opening credit sequence, a Hot Wheels-style version of the story with toy cars tearing down the road and going through a loop, is a joy. And perhaps the best example of how Duster makes its reverence for old pop culture feel just new enough to work. Duster has 3.5 stars and airs on Max on Thursdays. The AI is not okay. Rise of the TV Addicted Machine. Murderbot, airing on Apple TV Plus on Fridays with 3.5 stars. Is the titular character from this comedy based on Martha Wells' books the most relatable character in science fiction history? Yes. The security unit, Alexander Skarsgård, has no genitals and various deadly weapons built into his artificial body. But his desires are simple. All I really wanted was to be left alone to watch my shows. After figuring out how to disable the module that forces him to obey his owner's commands, his first order of business is to download thousands of hours of serialized dramas and watch them while his human clients jabber away about their problems. Skarsgård has already seen Machine Made, and his dry delivery leans into the way that Wells and now TV producers Chris and Paul Weitz write Murderbot, as if he has autism, struggling with eye contact, struggling to understand emotion and social cues, obsessing over a single interest. And the characters around him feel like actual people living in a sci-fi world. Love Incorporated. Welcome to the modern dating game. The movie Materialists, in theaters on June 13th. 3.5 stars. Dating is a risk, says Lucy, played by Dakota Johnson, and she specializes in risk management. For a fee, this matchmaker sets people up with their ideal partner, tall, petite, male, female, rich, very rich. Lucy is attending the wedding of a client when she meets Harry, played by Pedro Pascal, the groom's brother, a refined finance bro who's also handsome and signal. Lucy sees him as a ringer for her service. He wants to date her. The fact that Lucy's ex, a struggling actor named John, played by Chris Evans, is working the party as a waiter complicates their meet-cute. Past Lives writer-director Celine Song sets her sights on another obtuse love triangle, but here balances fairy tale romance with recession-era realities. Both Lucy and the movie are continually weighing how much the perfect match depends on economics. It may lack the swoony high of Song's debut, yet this follow-up movie proves that she's anything but a flash in the pan. Twee Chairs, The Art of the Quirky and Curious Deal. The movie, The Phoenician Scheme, in theaters on May 30th with 3.5 stars. Meet Anatole Zaza Korda, played by Benicio del Toro, international magnate of mystery. His long reign as the 20th century greatest globe-trotting industrialist has made him a target, and though he survived 6 shady plane crashes and various assassination attempts, Korda's rivals are still out for his head. Should he perish, his headstrong daughter, Liesl, played by Mia Tripolitan, will inherit his fortune provided she avenges his death. The young woman would rather become a nun, yet she accompanies Dad to the four corners of the earth as he tries to finish one last deal. They face perils along the way. Gangsters, terrorists, quicksand, a winner-take-all hoops game. Their biggest obstacle, though, may be the years of paternal neglect that have left Liesl resentful. The latest film from Wes Anderson has everything you'd expect. An all-star ensemble. A partial cast list includes Scarlett Johansson, Wilhelm Dafoe, Jeffrey Wright, Benedict Cumberbatch, Bryan Cranston, and Tom Hanks. Bill Murray naturally plays God. A production designed, pitched between precocious and delirious, and the perfect mix of pathos and absurdity. If you've ever wanted to hear Michael Cera lecture on praying mantises in the serious Scandinavian accent, this is your jam. But it's also a touching story of a father figure trying to connect with a young counterpart, another Anderson specialty, see Rushmore and the Royal Tenenbaums. It's the best thing Del Toro has done in ages, and in a perfect world, should turn Thrupulton into a breakout star. The way the British actor and daughter of Kate Winslet takes to Anderson's style of quirkiness and can turn a barely discernible shrug into a killer visual gag is damn near priceless. Living Color, cringe comedy meets a new generation. The show Adults on Hulu. All episodes are now streaming. 4 stars. This comedy about 5 Gen Z friends sharing a house in Queens opens with a scene where Issa, played by Amita Rowe, decides the best way to combat a subway masturbator is to loudly gratify herself at the same time. The show Adults is loaded with stories where the roommates take the worst possible approach to solving a problem while also having no real interest in privacy or decorum. They're so close that Billy, played by Lucy Fryer, not only doesn't mind that the others come into the bathroom while she's on the toilet, but also answers their questions about whether she's peeing or pooping. They're able to unilaterally apply house rules that the others have to follow, like when Issa tells Billy she can't keep visiting her high school to make herself feel better. Adults can be unbearably awkward at times, but explosively funny far more often. Says Samir, played by Makiel Esel, always thought the world was going to be waiting for me, and instead, everyone's annoyed that I'm here. No one will be annoyed that Adults has arrived. And now on to a Rolling Stone featured article. I was taken hostage. How an American metal rocker landed in Russian prison. One minute, Travis Leak was trying to decide which movie he and his fiancée should watch in his rented apartment on the outskirts of Moscow. The next, he was lying face down on the floor in a small pool of his own blood. On that early June afternoon in 2023, Leakey heard a pounding on the door of his unit in a 3-story building on a tree-lined street. Ever since he moved from the United States to Russia 6 years earlier, Leakey had toggled between teaching English to locals and attempting to get his fledgling grunge metal band off the ground. In videos and photos on social media, Leakey, now in his early 50s, had the aura of an elder statesman gone punk. The pandemic had shut down any hope of his band's live shows, and a book he planned to co-write about Anthony Bourdain, on whose show he had appeared, had fallen through. But he felt so at home in Russia that he didn't think of leaving even after the events of the previous year. Leakey found himself facing 4 masked, uniformed Russian tactical cops brandishing assault weapons. Police detectives followed behind. According to one account, police said they were acting on a tip about drugs and money. As Leakey tells it, he raised his hands in surrender, but the police pushed him to the ground and handcuffed him so roughly his wrists soon began to bleed. He was then kicked in the chest as cops taunted him and dragged him across the floor. He remembers watching as his fiancée, a Russian native, was subjected to an intrusive body cavity search. The cops also seized his cell phone and tore apart his home of 2 years, wrecking his recording setup in the process. Leakey says a couple had been talking about starting a bath bomb company, and a pile of those ingredients, including baking soda and citric acid, was on display. He says the cops slapped him, trying to get him to admit the soap components were drug paraphernalia. Leakey remembers a plastic baggie being placed on his head and feeling it fall off. All along, the police filmed the raid. Back in Bakersfield, California, where Leakey had spent most of his childhood, his mother, Glenda Garcia, learned from a reporter that her son, whom she hadn't seen in person since 2017, had been arrested on suspicion of drug trafficking. As a statement from the Russian government read, the Komnenovsky District Court of Moscow took a preventive measure against an American citizen. Leakey was finally receiving the recognition he long craved, but not remotely in the way he once dreamed. By last account, dozens of Americans are being detained in countries around the world. Under Joe Biden's administration, more than 75 were brought back to the States from China, Russia, Iran, and other countries. In Russia, WNBA star Brittany Griner was released in a prisoner swap in 2022, followed last year by the release of Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gerstovich. But in Russia alone, at least 10 more Americans, and many from other countries, remain, some officially deemed by their government to be wrongfully detained, and others like Leakey, not. When Interfax, the Russian news agency, announced his arrest, Leakey was described as, among other things, a musician and former U.S. paratrooper. Most in the American music world had never heard of him, and some of the information, such as his military record, was overstated. But the real focus was on the charges leveled against Leakey, that he and a former girlfriend were essentially a two-person drug trafficking ring attempting to sell methadone, a stimulant akin to a combo of cocaine and speed, in Russia. In July, more than a year after his arrest, Leakey was sentenced to 13 years in a penal colony, his co-defendant and fiancé to 8. Leakey's arrest and detainment made international headlines for a few days, but unlike other Americans who were designated by the U.S. to be wrongfully detained, his story quickly faded from public view. Last year, under Joe Biden, the U.S. State Department would not comment on Leakey's situation to Rolling Stone, only offering a general statement that the department has no other priority than the safety and security of U.S. citizens abroad. Starting last fall, I began reaching out to Leakey's family and friends, both here and in Russia, to understand how a California computer geek found himself fronting a Russian rock band and then getting arrested on drug charges. The investigation eventually led to Leakey himself, who, by way of handwritten letters sent to his mother, agreed to answer my questions, largely on the record. The two responses I've received to date, adding up to nearly a dozen pages, are composed in clear, concise, if tiny handwriting, partly, according to his mother, to lessen the per-page charges for such correspondence. In them, Leakey lays out his story and maintains his innocence, insisting that the drugs in his home were planted and that he was targeted by the government. As he wrote in December, "I don't expect nor require anyone to merely take my word for any of this. The evidence is clear and consistent. I was taken hostage and the government buried exculpatory evidence with intent." The change in administration from Biden to Donald Trump has given Leakey and his family and those working on his behalf to free him a degree of hope. On March 9th, Trump continued U.S. Hostage and Wrongful Detainee Day, first declared in 2023, announcing that his administration is proudly taking decisive action to bring Americans back home where they belong, and rattling off the names of 13 Americans held captive who are now released from Russia, Venezuela, Afghanistan, and Belarus. Whether Leakey will eventually join that list remains unknown, and he and some people who know him wonder if his arrest and imprisonment, presuming he is innocent, were connected to the Ukraine invasion, Russian-American relations, his political beliefs, his part-time job as a rock musician, or even his appearance on that Bourdain TV episode more than a decade later. In his letters, Leakey acknowledges the risks of communicating to the outside world, but he feels he needs to tell his side of the story. As he writes on one page, "Before I was killed, I had a simple, joyous, and truthfully almost magical and long-sought-for life. I was happy. Wasn't rich or famous, but trying. Found my place in this fucked-up world." But in a follow-up, he adds, "I'm in hell, a burning, bleak, creeping, obscene, solitary, seemingly endless, obscured, bottomless pit of freefall through Satan's asshole." For Leakey, Russia was a place where he finally fit in, a place where he found a community that allowed him to redefine himself, only to see it fall away in an instant. "Travis was naive," says computer tech Michael Kammer, who knew Leakey as a teen and reconnected with him in Russia. He thought that if you played by the rules, nothing bad would happen. I told him no, that if somebody is out to get you and they have power, they can get you. In the mid-80s, a teenage Leakey would drop by Cameron's computer store in a strip mall in Bakersfield. With his shaggy dark hair, he looked at Cameron like he could have been a mop-topped member of the Goonies cast. Leakey was always asking questions about computers, and Cameron noticed he often carried around an instruction book on complex C computer programming. I thought, what the heck is a 17-year-old kid doing with C language, Cameron says. It was above my head. It really impressed me. Leakey also struck Cameron as kind of a dour, sad kid and suspected his family life was complicated, although Leakey never discussed it. Michael Travis Leakey was born in Norwalk, California in 1971. He and his family, his father Curtis and mother Garcia, were then living in Orange County. The family soon moved north of Los Angeles. When Leakey was 9, his parents broke up, making him a latchkey kid like many in Generation X. It was really rough on him, Garcia, his mother admits. Years later, Leakey would write a song called Dude, You're Not My Dad, which he called a hilarious and ultimately meaningful song about children of divorce. After graduating from West High School in Bakersfield in 1989, Leakey signed up for service, training as a refrigeration technician at an Air Force base in Texas. He was just searching for something to do, his mother said. Leakey writes in one of his letters that he fell into a severe depression after transferring to Luke Air Force Base in Arizona, attempted suicide, and was honorably discharged. Around this time, he also began insisting to family and friends that he be known as Travis, not Michael. He said, there are too many Michaels in the world, says his mother. In his early 20s, Leakey moved to Texas, where he took a job at a car dealership and looked, says his friend Monty Hightower, a little nerdy in his preppy clothes. But he eventually made his way back to California. For a few years in the mid-2000s, he was married to a Ukrainian who his mother thinks he met online. When Leakey was laid off from his job at a Toyota dealership around the time of the 2008 financial crash, he asked if he could move back in with his mom and her new husband near Sacramento. His mom told her son he could as long as he got a new job or went back to school. He opted for the latter, earning degrees at American River College and California State University in Sacramento. At American River, Leakey's new girlfriend, a Ukrainian-American woman, called him one evening to gush over a new band she'd heard, Slot, roaring Russian rap metalheads with male and female lead singers, like a merger of Evanescence and Linkin Park. A product of the 80s and 90s, Leakey had grown up immersed in everything from Billy Joe and Garth Brooks to Depeche Mode, what he describes to me as music with interesting, thoughtful lyrics. But he was largely drawn to what he calls the heavier side of mainstream rock. I'm a 90s guy. I love grunge, all of it. Leakey says he fell in love with Slot's music. Curious as to what they were saying in their songs, he translated them and posted lyric videos online, including for the song Voodoo Doll. The lyrics are, I am a voodoo doll. There will be no crying. I am a voodoo doll. I will not forget anything. After subtitling a few videos for YouTube, the band reached out, he writes. They wanted to make an international album. Of course, I agreed. On May 25, 2010, Leakey made his faithful first trip to the country whose music scene would prove his destiny and his possible ruin. By the time Leakey landed in Russia, the country's music scene had been transformed. According to Dmitry Spirin, singer of the pivotal Russian rock band Taranki, another word for cockroaches, a community once home to very few clubs and only one record label, was suddenly thriving. The Russian music world now encompassed recording studios, more labels, bands from punk to metal to alternative, and clubs like Ikra, where Gogol Bordello, fronted by Ukrainian-born Eugene Hutz, made its Russian debut. The 1,500-seat Tochka and a cluster of small, more subterranean venues. And in that scene, a world of smoking, drinking, ready-to-rock Russian music heads, Spirin took note of a new addition from overseas. I knew that there were some Americans hanging out with our colleagues from the scene, he says, just a friend of the musicians or a guy who does something for them. Leakey lives something of a dual life, teaching English to employees of Russian corporations as well as private students. According to his mother, he bartered for dental work by teaching English to a dentist's daughter. And after meeting the members of SLOT, who did not respond to requests for comment, Leakey ingratiated himself into the Russian rock world, going to clubs and helping local bands write English language lyrics so they could possibly cross over in America. He, of course, said everything that all my American friends since the mid-90s have said about life in Moscow, Spirin says. Fun, lots of hot girls, for whom you are Mr. American, cheap booze, the opportunity to hang out with alternative stars, and even be useful to them. I don't think at his age you have a chance to live that kind of life in Burbank. Serving as executive producer and lyric translator, Leakey helped SLOT with their first English language album, Break the Code, in 2011. With Travis, it's the only way we found to make our CD into English as we want it, lead singer Daria Ravidina told metal website Sonic Cathedral in 2011. Maybe the most important thing is that we have relied on him to make sure that the way we sing is appropriate for the Western world. Leakey also connected with Luna, a band that blended punk, indie, metal, and anti-religious, anti-government lyrics, and he helped Spurin's band translate its lyrics into English. By then, Russia's slide into autocracy was apparent, despite Vladimir Putin's briefly stepping aside from the presidency, and according to the U.S. Department of State, there were in 2010 numerous reports of governmental and societal human rights problems and abuses during the year. But for Leakey, the country offered a welcome mat. I love my work and my life here, he writes. I never anywhere felt so necessary and fulfilled. Says Spirin, Leakey loved Russia very much. I always joked that he was a bigger Russian patriot than all of us, his Russian friends. It was already clear to all of us that we were living under a new Stalin, who sooner or later would start killing oppositionists and start a war. Travis did not want to hear about it. Eventually returning to the U.S., Leakey started his own indie label, Red Decade Records, in Bakersfield. Red Decade's sole release was Luna's Behind a Mask, which included versions of the band's older songs, but with newly recorded English sung lyrics translated by Leakey. With Leakey serving as tour manager and driver, Luna embarked on their first American tour in 2013. That same year, Luna, who declined to comment, were scheduled to be included into an MTV Europe show, Rebel Music, about anti-authoritarian bands. When the band was cut from the show for unexplained reasons, Leakey was contacted by Burdine's team, who were about to film an episode of the chef's travel and food series, Parts Unknown in Russia. The Russian punk band Pussy Riot had canceled due to a scheduling conflict, and Burdine now wanted to interview Luna instead. As Leakey writes to me in one of his letters, that interview became ultimately a defining moment in my life, and perhaps not in the best way. In early 2014, Leakey and Luna guitarist Ruben Kazan found themselves at a table in Moscow's 16 Tons Club. There, Leakey's makeover was on full display. The short-haired young professional of the 80s and 90s had given way to a 42-year-old with a head shaved on both sides, earrings, and a pierced eyebrow. He and Kazan and Bourdain took a seat at a table, and according to Zamir Gata, who was a recurring guest on Bourdain's series and a close friend, Leakey seemed to revel in the attention. In his earpiece, Bourdain heard some technical interference, and Leakey half-joked that the KGB was likely blocking your signal, adding, I'm sure that they are, believe it or not. I'm quite sure you had someone on your tail the entire time you've been here. As customers drank around them, talk turned to Luna's exclusion from the MTV show, which Leakey blamed on the Russian government. This was a documentary series about musicians standing up and risking their lives in some cases to stand up against government abuse of power, government corruption, he tells Bourdain in the episode. And yet a foreign government was able to editorially control what American viewers see on their TV screens. That, to me, is a scandal of epic proportions. When the episode of Parts Unknown aired on CNN in May 2014, Leakey's mother watched anxiously at home. That was nerve-wracking for me, she says. I was afraid he'd say something that would have got him arrested immediately. It concerns a mother, you know. But he said he'd be fine. Not long after the Bourdain show, though, Leakey sensed something changing around him. Things started feeling odd in Russia for me as the months progressed in 2014, he writes. I attributed it to the CNN interview. Maybe it was just paranoia, I never know. Partly because of that feeling, he returned to California later that year, taking jobs as a substitute teacher and working as an extra in TV and movies. In 2015, he also returned to school, enrolling at California State University in LA and earning his master's in early 2017. But he wasn't happy with his life or the politics in his native country. A second marriage ended as abruptly as his first had. And on social media, he became critical of Barack Obama, as he called him, the head idiot in charge, and posted selfies with conservatives Sean Hannity and Newt Gingrich. As he wrote on socials in 2016, Leakey resisted categorization. I consider myself an objectivist. I'm neither conservative nor liberal, nor in between, nor at some extreme edge of anything connected. Stop reading headlines and actually invest time in your own mental, spiritual, and psychological development, and do your own research from primary sources that don't have three letters attached to them anywhere. This means no more Fox, no more CNN, ABC, CBS, NPR, and so forth. Before long, Leakey began formulating a plan to Russia. To save money while he was back in college, he lives for a time in his Honda Accord, parking near the school's library for free Wi-Fi and showering in a nearby gym. I had just got divorced for the second time. I felt completely isolated from the world, and the politics of my own country were such as to make me feel like I had no hope of ever finding anything worthwhile in life, he told Russian writer Vladimir Ekovich for the book Cockroaches, with an exclamation mark at the end. I actually planned to spend that summer in Moscow and then return to USA. He added that he would commit suicide by jumping from the top of the English Department building at Cal State Los Angeles. It's unclear if he was joking about that part of his plan. Returning to Russia that summer of 2016 proved to Leakey that he felt more at home there than in the U.S. When I was back in Moscow, I realized just how much I was missed and how much I missed working in music, he writes in one of his letters. He continued his translation work with Burns Band and was eventually offered the chance to sing lead on one of its songs, Who You Were Yesterday, with the lyrics, Looking Back, these lyrics seem prophetic now. After the summer, Leakey came to America determined to return to Moscow to relocate. In January 2017, his mother and her husband drove Leakey to LAX for another flight back to Russia. I thought he was crazy to move to Russia, his mother says, but he's an adult. You can't live their life for them. Gada, Bourdain's colleague, couldn't help but marvel at the sight. It was September 2019, and on stage on the cramped Live Stars Club in Moscow was a very different Leakey from the one he'd met 5 years earlier. In a black pullover, his hair blonde and straggly, a bulkier Leakey was now a metal badass and the frontman of his own band, Lovinoc, also called Seize the Night. Although the band's industrial grunge wasn't Gotti's favorite, he called Leakey an impressive singer. Leakey and Gotti began working on a book about Gotti's time with Bourdain, who died in 2018. The collaboration eventually ended when the two disagreed on an approach for the book. But working with Tarkany made Leakey realize how much he wanted a band of his own. Leakey recruited local experienced musicians and formed Lovinoc as a showcase for his singing and writing. Says Spearin, there are many Russian musicians who sing in English, and there are also many fans of Western rock who expect a guy from America to sing in English. But Travis came up with the idea to do everything the other way around. He apparently decided to become the first American to become famous on the Russian rock scene by performing his own songs in Russian. Leakey's former girlfriend, Karen Stallings, remember him saying, it was a lot easier to break your band in Russia than here. While he resumed teaching, Leakey began sitting in with other Rush bands at clubs. Thanks to social media, Leakey also connected with a few old friends, including Kammer, his computer store buddy from Bakersfield. Kammer had no idea Leakey was now in Russia, and in their video calls, Kammer took note of his friend's apartment with its small kitchenette in an area set up as a makeshift recording studio. Leakey sent Cameron audio files he made, including the songs Path of Wreckage and Who Is Nigh Yet, rap metal pounders that sounds like a Putin-era version of 21 Pilots. Every so often, Cameron would ask Leakey if he was concerned about living under a Russian regime, and Leakey didn't seem especially worried. He saw beauty in the way the people overcame it, Cameron says. There's the overall oppressiveness, but the average day-to-day people were great. He said, it's not as oppressive as you think, as long as you know where the lines are. In late 2021, Leakey also got back in touch with Monty Hightower from his time in Texas. She asked him how he felt about the situation with Putin, and he told her he had always had to be careful what he said. They're always listening. That's what he said, Hightower recalls. But Leakey went on to say, this place is beautiful. I love it here. Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 did nothing to stop Leakey's plans. I tried to convince him to leave Moscow, Spirin says. I told him it was unsafe for him as a foreigner American, since I was sure Putin would put them all in jail sooner or later, not only because they were citizens of potential enemy countries, but to form a so-called exchange fund. Leakey just laughed, said how good he was in Moscow, and even joked, thank you for leaving us your women. But in April 2022 Facebook post, Leakey let on that life in Russia could be unnerving. He wrote, I've taken necessary precautions and have five different individuals who I've asked to check in with me weekly with specific instructions on who to contact and next steps if they are unable to reach me. No one has paid me a visit or tried to intimidate me. I have received no odd phone calls or untoward messages. In fact, I've had almost universally positive encouragement for my decision to remain here in Russia from people of all backgrounds. Leakey added that he would otherwise keep his opinions to himself and hope for a swift end to the war with Ukraine. Leakey ended with, please don't panic, everybody. And that's it for today. Thank you for listening to Rolling Stone Magazine. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.